This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 5th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up, we continue our coverage of Dutch Design Week from last week's show. Today we're in Eindhoven, meeting the winner of the Mini Dutch Design Award, Femke Ere Graven.
I think I'm very outspoken in my work, so I'm not scared of making a statement or putting my work into use for something that I support.
And something for the infants among you listening, we visit what is billed as Belgrade's first design playground.
This is the first playground in Belgrade, and I guarantee you that allows the kid to fall on its head, get up again and go on. And that is a big difference.
And then we visit Istanbul to look at the murky history of the city's Ottoman architectural heritage.
From the Armenian perspective, they overemphasize their creativity. They stress that they graduated from architecture in the College Sambab, which never even had an architecture department, for instance.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. If you tuned into last week's show, you would know the Section D team decamped the Netherlands for a special broadcast dedicated to Dutch Design Week. We met the director of the event, Martijn Paulen, who told us his chosen title for the festival, Now Future. He said it was designed to inspire the exhibitors to look onwards with optimism, with a renewed zeal of professionalism.
I honestly believe that the future is about combining the left half and the right half of your brain. Bringing the nerds, bringing the creatives, and them together will bring the solutions for the future. And we have that DNA right here in the heart of our city.
We also paid tribute to the legacy of tech giants Philips in Eindhoven, whose creations have been taken on the world over since its founders Gerard and his father Frederick produced the incandescent lamp in 1891. Here's what Rogier van der Heide, chief design officer of Philips Lighting, had to say.
That makes Philips in the collaboration really an enabler, because the fashion designer has a dream. And our technologies in the field of integration of fabrics and light make that dream become real.
That was last week. And this time round, we've got some more highlights from our trip, including an interview with a former Philips designer turned baker who was exhibiting his wares in Eindhoven last week. But first, in the heart of the former Philips factory Stripe area lies the iconic Klokkerboe, or Clock Building, a monument to Eindhoven's industrial past. The blue Philips name adorns the clock itself, overlooking the renovated warehouse complex below, now home to hundreds of creative companies that have moved in after the departure of the manufacturing sector. During Dutch Design Week, Organisation in Design curated the Klokkerboe exhibitions. Under the direction of art directors Margot Konings and Margriet Vollenberg, established as well as emerging designers are given an equal platform for the thousands of visitors to see. Marco gave our producer Ella John a tour of the space.
So we are in the entrance hall of the Klokkerboe building now, and this hall is where we really wanted to make a connection with the city of Eindhoven. Because I think that during this week, the city of Eindhoven, but also all the exhibitions around the city, they are together what makes the Dutch Design Week into what it is. So what we did is that we put a caterer there, super creative, crazy explosion guy who has the restaurant across the street here as well. But we wanted him in here because he's really like Eindhoven DNA for me. I know that he's the local creative idiot, so to say, but that gives us the perfect atmosphere that I also want to have in this Klokkerboe building. Then we go into this part of the exhibition. We call this the Ode to the City. And it's actually an exhibition in which we pay homage to the exhibitors that are in Eindhoven. So what we did is that we have these balloon structures here on which you see short movies projected that give a feeling of the atmosphere that you can find in all the other locations that are in Eindhoven in this moment. And we have...
As part of Dutch Design Week.
As part of Dutch Design Week, absolutely.
So the three areas, talk me through them. It's we are the in the strip at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Then you have the Sexy Sea area, that's the east area. And then you have the center area. And in those three areas, you find over 80 locations where you can see different exhibitions. So we took a selection of them and projected them here to show also the visitors of the Glockgebouw what else there is to see, to hopefully motivate them to go there as well. Here you can see all three of those areas, really literally printed on a wall. And also we obviously chose to make this index that really mentions all exhibitors that are in Eindhoven this week. Because for us it was really important to really make a direct connection with everything that is happening here.
That's one of the first things I mentioned to you, that it's quite difficult at first. It's such a big event.
It is.
Finding not just the exhibitors you want to see, but also finding your way around the city. But that's your role. As part of the team that has organized this particular exhibition.
For us, it was important to really pay that homage to the city and to really give that idea of what it enhances, that whole design week. Because the Glockgebouw is one of, in square meters, is one of the biggest locations during the Dutch Design Week. But it was focused on itself, so to say. And we really wanted to open it up and connect it with the city. I think that's super important for a week like this.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the Glockgebouw itself. It's a former Philips building, but its role within Dutch Design Week before. You've taken it on, this is the first year that you and the organization and design team have run it.
Yeah.
How have you changed it from the previous years?
Yeah, we have completely changed it. We have done a few things to change it. First and most important thing is that we have made a very strict selection on who could present here. Glockgebouw receives, and the Dutch Design Week, they receive a lot of applications from designers from outside Eindhoven that want to present here. And they all could be in the Glockgebouw, but we said no, they cannot all be in the Glockgebouw building. We really have to make a strong selection of who is going to be here. Because the Glockgebouw has to be a place where you can see like an overall view of the quality that the Dutch Design Week represents. And therefore we really wanted to have exhibitors that are in a certain quality as well.
It's kind of a prism through which you see the rest of the Dutch Design Week.
A little bit. But it's not like if you see this, you've seen the Dutch Design Week. Not at all. But it does reflect a little bit of everything that you can see. So it gives you the idea of the differentiation that you can see in this week here.
So where are we now?
We are now in the first hall of the Glockgebouw building, where we made a composed exhibition. And one of the other main things that we changed this year is that we opened the Glockgebouw up for international exhibitors as well. Previously, Dutch Design Week was always very strict in presenting Dutch design. And we said that is not of this time anymore, because the world is globalizing completely. Everything is open, either via the internet, boundaries are taken away. Design is an international thing, so you cannot only present Dutch design. And if you want to present Dutch design, you have to present it in a broader international context to show its relevance, but also to attract a more vast group of professional visitors. When you have like a bigger international group to present, and not only Dutch design, it will also be more interesting for the visitors to see.
I imagine that may have been something quite tricky to convince certain people involved in the organization of this event.
Yeah, it was tricky to convince certain people in the organization of, because they always did it differently, and they've been working on Dutch Design Week for many, many years, so of course that is difficult. The luck we had is that the director is also new. He started in May last year, and he really asked us not only to take on this project, but also to advise him on the Dutch Design Week and how the Dutch Design Week as a whole could become a more, even a better event than it already was. And he was on our hands straight away, because he completely understood why it was important to have that international opening there.
Before we take a look around the hall, I wonder if you could try and describe what Dutch design is. It's interesting that you wanted to break down the boundaries of from Dutch to more global exhibitors and designers. It's something that I've been speaking to a lot of people about. What makes Dutch design Dutch?
What makes Dutch design Dutch is...
What makes it different from other designers?
I think it's the conceptual approach that Dutch design has, and that is something that is, for example, the Design Academy Eindhoven is really known for their conceptual way of educating designers. So it's not that much about making smooth, finished products, but it's really about the processes. What are your ideas? What is your concept? And how do you come in a process to a certain endpoint? And the endpoint doesn't have to be a finished design. The endpoint can also be a suggestion to change politics, to change economics. It can go in all directions in that way. And I think that is something that is typical for Dutch design, because Dutch design, Holland as a country, has always, we have always been traveling and we've been trading and we've been going everywhere. And in that way, we have a culture that is very used to being open to other influences. And I think that also reflects on the design world, and that is something that is very typical for Dutch design. Besides, of course, Dutch design also being a little bit minimalistic. It can come with a blink, you know what I mean? It can have a little bit of a joke in it. It can be challenging.
It's an idea that it is quite, could be quite wacky or maybe potentially slightly weird.
It can be potentially slightly weird because it's changing the future, I think. It's in Holland, you see now that designers are collaborating with big building companies, but also with governments, with universities, with research institutions. You also see that via the RCA, of course, because they have a similar way of thinking in that. But I think that openness, that open spirit, that is something typically Dutch to me.
Professionalization, or the professionalism of the industry, is something which I know you're quite focused on.
Yeah.
What role do you play, or your organization, what role does it play in improving the professionalization of design?
We, first of all, I think it's important that our role is always in the background, because we are always, our main focus is always on providing the best platform for designers, for the exhibitors that are with us. The roles we play is that we create a platform for them, we open up our network to them, so we invite our network, and we have like thousands and thousands of good contacts with press, but also with labels, with producers, with museums, with galleries, and we really try to create a platform for our exhibitors to be seen by those people and further professionalize in a way that they can make new connections and can make business out of it.
This is quite a tight selection of exhibitors and designers, and broad in the sense that you have some established names as well as young emerging designers perhaps. What goes into the curatorial process then? Because it's obviously, it's of great importance for you as an organizer.
Yeah, it is.
In the past, the Klokkebouw perhaps was known for having too many designers and you couldn't distinguish too many on top of each other. But now there's a lot of space, the gangways are quite wide, you have time and you can see things in quite a lot of detail. Tell me what goes into that process for you.
Into the curatorial process? It's not that we work with a list of rules, so to say. It's really a thing that is based on gut feeling, actually. It's instinct, it's gut feeling, it's experience. We've been doing this for many years. We visit a lot of fairs, we see a lot of exhibitions, and also our network constantly feeds us with what is happening in the now, so what is important now. And that is how we base our selection. So actually, it's a really natural process. We always want to create enough space for the designers to really show their projects in a good way, but also for the visitors to have enough space and air to carefully look at things, to take some extra time to look at things instead of walking past and 1.5 seconds you have to know if you like something or not, like the Facebook culture. We want to avoid that a little bit in the way we present our exhibitions, by giving room to inspiration, actually.
Margot Koenigs, Art Director of Organisation and Design, taking our Aled John on a tour of the exhibitions within Eindhoven's iconic Klokkebouw. More from Eindhoven after this. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. And next, we're back to Eindhoven, where after a successful career as a lighting designer, Dido van Klinken decided to radically change his working environment and working hours. Although just 6 months old, Dido's new bakery is a triumph of crusty batches in a suitably well thought out site in the centre of town. The designer cum baker has had to learn many new skills, but much of the approach and talent centred around making things look beautiful came in hand when it came to baking some of Holland's most talked about bread. Monocle's David Pleasant went to Dido's bakery, the Staatsbakkerij Broad.
I graduated in 93 from the Design Academy, and then actually almost straight on I went working for Philips Design, where I worked for 19 years, mainly in the area of lighting, but actually I designed lots of different stuff. So as a product designer. Half a year ago, I resigned to start a bakery, which may look like a big shift, and actually it is.
That shift, obviously as a designer, that's what you kind of involved all your attention and efforts and expertise in. Was it a kind of a personal decision? You wanted to get involved in bakery. How did you come to that decision? What made the change?
It started actually, I think, by coincidence, like 5 years ago, when I started, I wanted to bake a bread for myself just for dinner in the weekend, and it turned out terribly. And then I started looking up on the internet how to make a proper bread or a better bread. So I started, like after a few times, I got quite a decent bread, but then I had the idea my oven is not the proper oven, and I built my own wood-fired oven in my garden, which is quite huge. And you put the wood in it for 4 hours or something to get it up to temperature. And of course, then you're not going to bake one bread anymore. So I started baking more breads. And they were quite good, I guess, because people wanted to have them. I have a huge place, which is like the walls are 90% glass. We're on the ground floor. In the back of the bakery, we have a greenery or...
Yeah, well, we're looking onto a rather nice little park, yeah.
Park, which is actually, it's nice for the people visiting here because you sit half in the green, but still inside the city center. And for us as a working place, it's also fantastic because I think most bakeries have windows only on the very near the ceiling, and you work only with TL light, for example. And then the whole bakery is transparent, so you look from the front to the back. People who are at the counter can see what the bakers are doing, and it also has to do with it's kind of translation from, okay, we want to be transparent, so the whole bakery is transparent, our process is transparent, everybody can see that we never pick our noses, for example. So it's also actually, so the customers are actually controlling us because they can see whatever we do.
I see sacks of flour at the back of the kitchen. How does it begin, you know, from start to end? What time do you start and so on?
For bakers, we're quite lazy. We start at 6:30. We start from scratch here. So we have flour, which is milled on between stones still, and actually with water power. And the wheat is all organic, and the flour as well. But here, because it's open, it's also like every day we make sure that it's completely cleaned and everything is put in its proper place and everything. So it should look very neat when people walk around here on the outside and look through the windows. It should look perfect. And it's also what I heard from other bakers. They say, oh, it's so clean here. You know, it's so that's the way I want it. It's easier. It looks nice and it's easier to clean. And it's my deformation as a designer that I cannot work in a chaotic place. You know, things should have their own place, should be neatly stored away.
Your background as a designer, how have you translated that? Apart from, I mean, obviously, visually, we're in a very designed space. There's obviously a lot of attention to detail has gone into where we're sitting right now. But in terms of kind of your philosophy, your work philosophy, how have you kind of taken those skills that you acquired all those years as a designer at Philips? How have you kind of translated them in your daily life as a baker? Do you still have some of the same processes?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think for me, it's like designing is also in the beginning when you go to the academy or school. First, you have to learn some basic skills, and it's the same with baking bread. First, you have to be able to make a basic bread before you can do something new. And my intention is to start baking new breads. So I call it traditional, because we bake in a traditional way with no additives, but innovative. So I want to make new shapes, new combinations of tastes, these kind of things. So I'm still learning the basics to be able to master the skills and then be able to do something new with it. It's also with painting. You cannot start painting abstract if you're not been painting, how you call it, figurative, before, so. This is our most wanted bread, I think. It's a pumpkin bread, I'm slicing it now so we can look inside. If you look on the inside, you see that it doesn't only have pumpkin seeds on the outside, which make it into pumpkin bread, but it also has the pumpkin meat inside. So we grind the pumpkin and we mix it through the dough, and it makes a very nice, juicy loaf in the end.
That was Dido van Klinken there, speaking to Monocle's David Pleasant. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, with over 2,000 designers at the 12th edition of Dutch Design Week, the whiff of social activism is never far away in a lot of what's on offer. Whether it's students emerging from Eindhoven Design Academy's 2013 graduation show, calling for more sustainable mobile phone use, or designers come activists calling for transparent banking practice. Femke Herregraven is one such designer, and was awarded this year's Mini Dutch Design Award for a young designer for her entire portfolio. It pulls no punches in pointing fingers at big corporate tax avoiders. Sound like design to you? She told Ale John why she thinks it is.
This is a project that I did 3 years ago in the financial district in Amsterdam, which is called De Zuidas. I was an artist in residency there, and it was quite difficult to learn which companies actually are located in this area. And when I asked around if I could not have a list of companies, they were like, no, not really, and if it was there, we would not give it to you. So I decided to, from this financial district, to basically create an index, you know, to break open this district, like which companies are actually here and why are they here. So I spent some weeks in the Chamber of Commerce register, collected all the companies per street and address, and what you see then is that actually on some addresses there's just a few companies, which is quite realistic. They have a real substance, as they call it, like a real company with employees and stuff.
A real presence in the in the establishment.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also a lot of addresses where there's more than thousands of mailbox companies, and those are managed by trust offices, as they are called. It's just a sort of administration office that provides a CEO, a bookkeeping, basically all the legal things that the Dutch law asks companies to have in order to operate here. But it's often a sort of non-operational holding. They don't really have any activities here except of passing through money.
And you've put these together in a selection of books.
Yeah.
Talk me through it, how it's laid out, how you designed it.
So this was a version where there were still three. Actually, now the updated version, it's one book. So how it works is that each page represents one address. So, for example, on this page, you see one company. On other addresses, you see that there's more. And so basically, the more white space that you see in the book, the more real activity and substance a company likely has. The more crowded pages actually just imply tax or financial regulation, or tax avoidance or avoidance of financial regulation in their own jurisdiction. And I think what's quite interesting is if you look at the names, for example, here Goldman Sachs, they also have a lot of mailbox companies here. Actually, recently it was known that Goldman Sachs here in the Zuidas had a mailbox company that had 34 billion passed through it. But what's generally interesting about these companies, it's their names. You see that a lot of these names are never meant for any kind of communication or even maybe to be pronounced. They're just a name that only has to exist on paper. And so there's, for example, a whole series of companies that are called Alpha 1, Alpha 2, Alpha, and then Bravo, Charlie, and it goes on. Yeah. So it's quite interesting also in the name what you can read in it, yeah.
Why did you decide on this process, not just the design of the book, but why did you decide on looking into perhaps the tax avoidance of multinationals or individuals, as you said before?
Well, I think while I was working on this, it became so obvious, like, it's what's going on here? Why are all these companies here? And then I started looking in the Dutch tax law, and what amazed me was that countries are so much in competition in keeping multinationals' companies there, is that they are really in a sort of war with tax rates. You know, if the UK lowers the corporate tax by 0.1%, then the Netherlands or Luxembourg has to go as well. And I mean, it's a kind of race to the bottom, right? So for me, it was also discovering like how maybe the person cleaning actually one of those buildings actually paying you know, 35% tax, while one of these multinationals can lower it down to 4%. And the sort of discrepancy, I wanted to research more.
So this definitely adheres to the title that you've been given in some of the literature written since you've won the award and leading up to it, after your nomination, that of a journalist slash designer or designer slash activist. Mm. Is that a title that you agree with?
Well, I mean, I think I'm very outspoken in my work, so I'm not scared of making a statement or putting my work into use for something that I support. When I did this project, I was invited to do a masterclass, which was called Curating Reality, New Tools for Investigative Journalism. And they wanted to invite artists and designers to think of what other ways we have to do it, for example, data journalism, and how you can create a sort of access or insight into these big chunks of data through means of design. And so for this project, I continue with the topic, which I call like sort of overall, it's like geographies of avoidance. This is sort of where all these projects fall a bit under. And then I thought, well, this is a very graphic design way, right? It's making books and making a sort of index, but it is a kind of tool, but it is still quite a conventional tool. And then I thought, like, wouldn't it be great if people themselves could see or investigate how these routes work, right? These tax avoidance routes. So what I did then is I collected basically information on withholding taxes from jurisdictions all around the world and corporate tax. So the realistic data, and I made an online game based on that. And the premise of the game is that you as a player are invited to avoid as much taxes as possible for a multinational of your choice. And you're playing in a landscape that is based on the realistic numbers. So actually by doing that, you use also the players as it's a sort of crowdsourced research, right? We together sort of investigate what are the possibilities that multinationals have to cut down their tax bill. And at the end of the game, each player is asked to upload his fiscal report, as it is called, which means that sort of graph is generated with the route and it's uploaded into a public database. So if you go to this website, you can just also in the database look at all the routes that have been generated by the players. And yes, it's on the one hand, it's speculative because we don't know if the multinational really would use it, but it's also a sort of mapping out of the possibilities that are actually there. And so I thought, you know, you can also make a data visualization of some or something like that, but it's much more passive. I thought it would be much more interesting to put actually people in the shoes of a multinational and see with what kind of decisions they have to make and what things they have to deal with.
Let's have a look.
It's called Texodus. Exodus, isn't it?
Prove your loyalty to our company by neutralizing our tax bill and submit your fiscal report at the end of the year.
Exactly. Then you are asked to choose your tax wizard, which is basically a sort of fiscal lawyer that advises you throughout the game a bit. So I'm just running a bit quickly through it, but you get messages and sort of alerts every now and then. So how it works is we choose News Corp, so we start from the US. I can, for example, here see what kind of tax treaties they have with other countries. And tax treaties are, of course, about lowering the normal corporate tax rate. So these are special agreements that they have that you can use.
In terms of the design then, how did you mitigate against the complexity? Did you have input into how the whole thing is laid out, or did you employ a web designer?
Oh, well, the design is all mine, and I worked with a game designer, so who basically wrote the algorithms, how all the data is connected. And I worked with the interaction designer, for example. He wrote a script that generates these reports. It is an example of how design can, you know, spark something, and it can create a snowball effect.
Winner of the Mini Dutch Design Award for a young designer, Femke Herregraven, talking to Aled there. Coming up, we say goodbye to the Netherlands and head east to profile one of the enduring architectural stories of Istanbul. And then we visit Belgrade's so-called first designer school playground. But first, after a recent alleged terror attack in Tiananmen Square once again highlighted tensions between the Uyghur population and the Chinese state, Questions arise about how ethnic minorities and Han Chinese can expect their own cultures, environments, and therefore buildings to be preserved in the face of China's rapid growth. The balance is yet to be struck, argues our next guest, who believes the respect of the design of Uyghur cities plays an important role in the relations of the nation. Design director and founder of Design Practice Office for Architectural Culture, Charles Fu, told Monocle's Emma Nelson why.
The People's Republic was founded in 1949. Of course, on the one hand, the government has been doing a lot of development in Xinjiang, you know, in terms of developing cities, developing buildings and facilities.
High speed as well.
High speed as well, yes.
Urban explosions.
Exactly. But, you know, behind all that, I would say it's the Han Chinese mentality. You know, and through that, the local education, ethnical education, culture, traditions are being more or less affected by that. And more Han Chinese are moving in. And also in terms of the developing cities, because originally in Xinjiang province, most of the cities are quite old. You know, they've been there and like that since, you know, 14th, 15th centuries. And so the urban context and architecture were absolutely splendid, and you see a lot of heritage in there.
Do you see a lot of heritage, or do you have very old cities with very, very new buildings which seem to forget what lay before them?
Mm-hmm. One of the examples is the capital, Urumqi. Before, it was the capital of Uyghurs region, but now it's, I would say, mostly Han city and quite modern. On the other hand, let me take another example, Kashgar or Kashi, the westernmost city in China, which is a purely Uyghur city. And the city context is medieval, and architecturally, most buildings were, you know, more than 200 or 300 years old, and let alone the architectural style and traditions. So when I was there about 15-16 years ago, the city was like that, and you see full of local culture, ethnical culture and traditions and history. But since 10 years ago, the Chinese government built a railway all the way from the inner China to Kashgar, and things started to change. And about 5 or 6 years ago, the government decided to renovate or redevelop most part of this city center, which was the historical, you know, beautiful historical
center.
And
when they mean renovate, not necessarily sympathetically.
Well, basically, the reason they said was health and safety. So they basically knocked down most of the historical buildings and built new buildings and basically wipe out the context of the city.
Charles Fu of London-based practice Office for Architectural Culture. You can catch the full interview by downloading episode 155 of The Globalist Asia from monocle.com or on iTunes. After the break, it's playtime in Belgrade. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. The design of children's playgrounds is one thing that's moved on considerably in recent decades. Today's children may never know the singular agony of skinning their elbows and knees on unforgiving tarmac after a swing dismount goes awry. Rubber and wood chips are now the far more limb-friendly surfaces of choice. But some places are still distinctly old school, among them Belgrade, which boasts plenty of play areas, but not many of which would pass muster on the grounds of either safety or imaginative design. Jovan Jelovac has taken that on as a personal insult. He's the organiser of the annual Belgrade Design Week, a parent and now the motivating force behind what he calls the city's first design playground. Our correspondent Guy Delorney went to check it out.
Belgrade certainly isn't short of playgrounds. You'll find them in parks in the old town and in front of tower blocks in Novi Beograd. But there's just not a lot of imagination or design that's gone into them. This one in Student Square is typical. It's got a small flat area with a few squeaky swings, a couple of metal climbing frames, some broken seesaws, and a stump of a roundabout that's gone missing. What's more, most of the playgrounds have a hard surface, which means that falling on your head just isn't an option you'd want to consider. That's why you'll often hear this. Polako means be careful or watch out, as does its close linguistic relative, pazi. And you can understand why Belgrade parents use these words so often. But now, there's a playground that's aiming to consign these words to the dustbin.
This is the first playground in Serbia that was made for parents not to shout Polako and Pazi anymore, and I'm very serious about it.
Jovan Jelovac organises Belgrade Design Week, and now what he calls Serbia's first design playground.
This is the first playground in Belgrade, and I guarantee you that allows the kid to fall on its head, you know, get up again and go on. And that is a big difference, because what we had so far in Belgrade was basically a big, big, big agglomeration of health and safety risks. And look at the kids climbing over there and really testing their limits and opportunities. There is no other place where I can do it. Look at this girl. She's trying to get down and she will fall, but it will be forgiven. And this way she can make a trial and error successfully work into her advantage. And this way we finally have created the place where parents will not shoot Polako and Pazi. Parents in Belgrade will finally, perhaps, hopefully, let go of over-protecting the children, which they have to.
The new playground is in one of the best-loved places in Belgrade, the park next to the ancient Kalemegdan fortress. But the design thinking is very much up to date, with a combination of Serbian architecture and equipment from Lapset in Finland.
Belgrade in Serbia does not have innovative design playground in terms that there are 3D things, there are hills and so on and so on. We commissioned a super cool young architectural team called MADA, who won the Serbian entry at the Venice Biennale last year to make something really original, really outstanding, and combined with the Lapset equipment, which for us was important because we wanted it to last for another 40 years, because we knew nobody's going to take care of it, knowing Belgrade well.
Nikola Andonov is one of said super cool young architects at the MADA Architecture Studio.
We actually tried and hopefully managed to make the hills become the one huge toy. The thing we now enjoy is the joy of kids running, you know, all around, flipping, falling on this beautiful rubber.
We created the topography of the playground to be an item, an exercise item in itself. This is also something nobody does, which is absolutely unclear to me. All playgrounds in Belgrade are created completely flat. Then you put simple play items on top of it, which makes no sense. Look at the topography of Belgrade. Look at the Kalemegdan Park around you. It's made exactly of these gulches and hills that you see here on the playground. Something like that is nothing sensational or important for anywhere in Western Europe, where this is a standard situation. But we hope with this we are serving as an inspiration not only for our crew, but for hundreds of people who are actually hopefully tomorrow taking up some lessons here and going to continue with this work.
And inspiration is the key to the Design Playground project. It's not supposed to be a one-off, but an example to be taken up across the capital and eventually all of Serbia. Luckily, one of the people with the power to make that happen agrees. Dejan Vasovic is city architect and deputy mayor of Belgrade.
It's really a pleasure to have something special designed for the purpose, for the place, and very well fitted. Unfortunately, you don't have the pictures how it looked like before. But right now it's completely different. It was dangerous, and we have the resolution from inspection to close the playground. So it fitted very well with the new young architects, with the ideas. City learned the lesson, so we will continue to put more design in our work. So it will, of course, improve everyone.
Until then, the children of Belgrade are free to climb and scramble in safety in at least one of the city's playgrounds, and perhaps they'll also gain an appreciation of design at the youngest possible age. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
During the 19th century, one family dominated architecture in Istanbul, the Balyans. They were Ottoman Armenians originally from East Anatolia, and three generations of the family built some of the most famous landmarks in the Ottoman Empire's capital city. Their work has stood as a testament to the Ottomans' embrace of westernization and to the contribution the empire's non-Muslim subjects made to imperial society. But some say they weren't actually architects at all. The controversy speaks to the bias, nationalism and poor understanding that has plagued historical scholarship of Ottoman architecture for more than a century. Caleb Lauer reports.
The sound of construction is the sound of Istanbul. Today, names like Doğuş, Ağlı, Limak and Cengiz dominate the trade, reshaping Turkey's biggest city. But in the 19th century, one family, the Balyans, dominated the city's landscape. Many of the family's most impressive works sit on the banks of the Bosphorus Strait.
Dear passenger, Bosphorus tour is on the 10
lira. Ferries on the famous waterway, carrying tourists, commuters, and even buskers working the decks, glide past the palaces, mosques, and barracks built by the Balyans. Members of the Balyan family served the Ottoman sultans in various capacities, from the start of the 18th century to the end of the 19th, advising on and administering imperial construction, architecture, and urban planning.
I like the Ortaköy Mosque the most.
Alison Wharton teaches at Mardin University and wrote her PhD dissertation on the Balyan family.
It's architecturally very interesting because the exterior of the mosque is actually curving, physically curving, as opposed to being a kind of solid vertical or horizontal plane. I think they were looking to Renaissance architecture, and it's quite similar to a building in Venice that may have been a model. Also, I like the dome, the trompe-l'oeil, the illusionistic paintwork of the dome. Because if you look just briefly, you think it's a copy of a Renaissance work. And then if you look more carefully, then you can see all these Islamic elements in it. Like you can see there's a whole line of mihrabs, which was obviously like a major theme of Islamic art and architecture. And then there's 8-pointed stars and other motifs. So yeah, I think it's interesting that if you look closer, you see all these hidden sort of messages in it. So if you look generally, you think just... ooh, westernization, you know, this is copying European Renaissance or Baroque, and then if you look more closely you can see the Ottoman elements of it.
This grappling of the Ottoman identity with Western influences is, in many ways, the essence of the story of the Balyans. And it happened within the broader context of the Ottoman state trying to modernize and meet the challenge of rising Western Europe. Despite reforms and innovations, the empire continued to lose wars and territory and ultimately legitimacy in the eyes of many of its subjects. The story of decline came to overshadow the story of modernization. And those that had embraced or brought home Western influences got a bad name. In particular, the Balyans began to be blamed for corrupting and mongrelizing Ottoman architecture.
They're described as people who have this promiscuous drive for imitation. They're considered to be cultural compradors who are subservient to the will of hegemonic Western forces.
Ahmet Ersoy teaches history at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul and is spending a year at Harvard, from where he spoke to me by phone.
We can say that largely this, you know, nationalist bias has excluded the input and the agency of non-Muslim actors in the Ottoman field.
The story of the Balyans in particular came to be divided between what might be called the Armenian perspective and the Ottoman or Turkish nationalist perspective.
Basically, the Armenian account is focused on the biographies of the Balyan family. From the Armenian perspective, they overemphasize the creativity. They stress that they graduated from architecture in the Collège Saint-Barbe, which never even had an architecture department, for instance. So they're really, really over-egging this kind of artistic genius figure thing.
The Ottoman or Turkish nationalist perspective is very different.
Ermeniler böyle bir şey hiçbir zaman düşünmediler. Sorun şuydu.
Seliman Can teaches in the Art History Department of Marmara University. He argues that there is insufficient evidence to claim that the Balyan family were actually architects, but were instead more simple and often corrupt construction magnates. John argues that the archives suggest the actual architects of many quote-unquote Balian works were actually Muslim. So, on the one hand, the Balians have been held up as symbols of the deep Armenian contribution to Ottoman society. And there is a tragic irony looming in this view. Despite their contribution, in the empire's last years, Armenians suffered the ultimate persecution. On the other hand, scholars like Salman Jan say the Balians' reputation is undeserved, even fraudulent, and has obscured Muslim contributions in the field. But it's not a question of which view is right and which is wrong. The problem is that the actual history is poorly understood, and because of this, the story is vulnerable to retellings based on pride, guilt, and bias. Getting to the bottom of things may require sorting out basic vocabulary. For example, the word architect may confuse more than it reveals.
Because we're talking about a very, very active, competitive construction sector in the 19th century. Not only architects themselves, but patrons, bureaucrats, designers, constructors, contractors, subcontractors, financiers, and a whole array of networks and alliances that bring these people together. And the word architect, mimar, which is also used in modern Turkish, is actually used not only for designers, but for many other people involved in the basic, you know, from menial jobs in the construction site to investors and contractors. I think we need to put aside these notions of auteurism in architecture and try to approach to what extent architects, designers, contractors, patrons work together in the design and construction process. You know, the Balians seem to be very, very important, prominent figures in the architectural field who coordinated most of these projects. But as yet, we still have to decipher the codes of their engagement and participation in these projects. So there's a good deal of ambiguity in that regard.
And there are many other unanswered questions.
The most interesting thing for me is their politics, actually, because I never got to the bottom of it.
Historians will eventually tell us why the Balian family enterprise suddenly dried up in the late 1890s, and what the evidence has to say about Serkis Balian, the last prominent Balian, and whether he was involved in Armenian separatist politics. But for now, the challenge is more fundamental: to build up a body of critical scholarship on a remarkable family and its relationship to a city's remarkable architecture. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Caleb Lauer.
And that brings us to the end of today's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, in tribute to the futuristic theme of this year's Dutch Design Week, here's Computer Love by Kraftwerk. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.